Our speaker today is Jonathan Parry. He is a Birmingham Research Fellow, which is much better than it sounds. I mean, Birmingham's a lovely place, but he's not just a research fellow, because those usually have a termination date. What this is a permanent appointment in the philosophy faculty at Birmingham with 5 years of little or no teaching, so all research for
that's what they told me, but it's not true.
That's what they told me, too. Anyway, well, so don't blame me. Anyway, before this, he was a postdoctoral researcher at the Stockholm Institute for the Ethics of War and Peace at Stockholm University. His work is in normative and applied ethics, and what's distinctive about it is that he deploys the resources of political philosophy and legal theory to a great extent in his work in normative and practical ethics. As we'll see today, he's written a lot about the role of consent and the role of authority in the justification for harming in defensive action generally and specifically in war. I'm embarrassed to have to tell you that, unlike last week's speaker, Jonathan is not a member of the House of Lords. He's never been president of the British Academy, and he's never even been a head of house of an Oxbridge college. Well, we'll see. I do know his work, though, and I can assure you that in spite of these grave disadvantages, he's going to give us a really splendid talk today. And his talk is Consent and the Justification of Defensive Force. Jonathan.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Jeff, and thanks for you all for coming. Okay, so this paper, as you can probably guess, concerns the justification of defensive harm, and by that I just mean harms that are inflicted on persons with the aim of preventing harm to others. I'm really worried about putting my water on this.
No, go ahead, I do it every time.
Really?
Yeah.
So much electronics on here. All right. Okay, so now, while there's a huge and sophisticated literature on this topic, it focuses almost overwhelmingly on cases of self-defense. So these cases feature just two main characters, aggressors and their victims. And the central question in these cases is just to explain why it seems that victims are intuitively permitted to harm aggressors, given that common sense morality contains a stringent constraint on intentional harming in normal cases. And the most common answer to that question holds that, at least under certain conditions, individuals can become liable to defensive harming, thereby losing their normal right not to be harmed and removing the normal constraint on harming people. And then debate is going to center on what exactly those liability conditions consist in. Now, I'm going to say almost nothing about the liability question here. In the cases I discuss, I'm just going to assume that the aggressor's liability is fairly uncontroversial. Instead, what I want to do here is look at cases of other defense. So these are cases which feature a third cast member, third-party rescuers. And rescuers are just individuals who have the ability to impose harms on aggressors in defense of victims. And surprisingly, or I think it's surprising, there are not that many sustained discussions of other defense in the literature. Now, of course, one explanation for that absence would be if the morality of other defense was entirely determined by the morality of self-defense. So that if it's permissible for a victim to inflict a certain amount of defensive harm on an aggressor, then it just follows that it's permissible for a third party to inflict that same harm on the aggressor in defense of the victim. So if that view is right, then there just isn't any independent work for a theory of other defense to do. So one way of justifying a theory of other defense is by showing that there are additional constraints on defending others that don't apply in cases of self-defense. So in this paper, I want to focus on one intuitive candidate for a constraint of that type, endorsed by several theorists, so including Jeff McMahon and Cecil Farber at Oxford, and also Chris Finley at Birmingham. And this constraint holds that the victim's will places an important constraint on defending others. So more specifically, we can call this the consent requirement. And as a lot of people phrase it, the idea is that other defense is justified only if those to be defended consent to defensive assistance. Obviously, that probably isn't quite right, because it seems to rule out cases of, for example, defending people who are unconscious. That seems pretty implausible. So I think the right story probably needs to include something like our defence is permissible only if those to be defended do not competently and explicitly refuse defensive assistance. So the relative notion is the absence of refusal rather than the presence of explicit consent. But I think we can put that aside, that complication. So the claim here is that victim consent, or as I've said, non-refusal, is an independent and necessary condition for permissively defending others. So in contrast to other standard components of a theory of defensive harm, the consent requirement focuses specifically on the relationship between victims and rescuers, rather than between victims and aggressors. So the thought is that harming an aggressor can be impermissible because doing so would wrong the victim, even if it wouldn't wrong the attacker. So if the consent requirement or something like it is defensible, then there is this moral asymmetry between self and other defence. The fact that a victim would be permitted to harm their aggressor doesn't entail that it would be permissible for a third party to do so, since the victim may just refuse their defensive assistance. So to help demonstrate this idea, consider the following case. We call this elevator one. And the case goes like this. Victim is taking a ride in an elevator. Aggressor begins to saw through the elevator cable because he hates victim, or she in this case, and wishes him dead. Rescuer is walking by is able to shoot aggressor with his sniper rifle, thereby saving victim. However, victim refuses intervention because he is, or in this case she, is deeply committed to non-violence. So in this kind of case, many people think that defending victim would be clearly impermissible, assuming, of course, the victim has full information, they're not irrational, being coerced, etc., etc. And I thought, the thought I take it is that, after all, it's the victim's life that is at stake, not anybody else's, so only they get to decide if and how it's defended. And I suppose this thought is just tracking the more general Mill-inspired anti-paternalist idea that one may not interfere with a competent individual merely for the sake of their own good. So on those matters, the individual is sovereign. I think we can get some further prima facie support for the consent requirement just by thinking about other cases. So here's one familiar from the medical ethics literature. So call this the patient case. Patient is ill and will die unless they receive a blood transfusion. Doctor has the means of giving the transfusion and can do so easily and safely. However, the patient explicitly and competently refuses that intervention because having the treatment would go against their deeply held religious commitments. So I take it in that case, it's pretty uncontroversial that it'd be wrong for the doctor to intervene to save the patient's life against their wishes. Now, obviously, you might think there's some important disanalogy between this case and the elevator case, and we can talk about those in the Q&A a bit. But I think the patient case does at least show that there's some general support for the consent requirement, in that it shows that most of us accept the idea that in at least some cases, individuals' refusal can make it impermissible to save them from lethal harm. So in the rest of the talk, I'm just going to grant, for the sake of argument, that the consent requirement does impose a necessary condition for defending others in cases like elevator. And that's because I'm interested in extending the discussion of the consent requirement by considering the relevance of consent in what I call multiple victim cases of other defence. So more precisely, these are cases in which three conditions hold, and those are on your handout. So condition one, an aggressor threatens unjustified harm to several victims. Do you need a handout, Jeff?
I'll grab one.
Second condition, a rescuer has the ability to prevent the threatened harm by imposing defensive harms on the aggressor. And the third condition is a really important one. Defending every victim is a condition of defending any. So in a sense, the benefits of defence are a bit like a public good, in that no beneficiary can be excluded from them. Now, even among the pretty small literature on other defence, these cases have rarely been explored in much detail. Where you do find discussion of these cases is in the literature on military humanitarian intervention. And what I find interesting is that many in those debates endorse some version of the consent requirement. So the thought being that if the victims of the injustices that give rise to a just cause for humanitarian intervention don't want intervention on their behalf, then doing so is impermissible. The problem, of course, is that those cases are really complicated with lots of variables at play. So what I want to do here is examine this consent variable in isolation, just stripping out other factors as much as possible. So to do that, I'm going to consider some fairly simple multiple victim cases that just involve small numbers of private individuals. But as I hope to show, even in these really simple cases, the role of consent is more complicated than both defenders of the consent requirement and its critics often suppose. Sorry, Jeff, what time am I supposed to go to? Do you reckon? What time did we start?
You can go till easily 20 past or 25 past.
Okay, great.
I mean, you can go as long as you need to. Ideally,
yep.
25 past.
Okay, sure. Okay, so the difficulty with multiple victim cases is pretty obvious. So groups aren't simply individuals writ large, rather they're composed of individuals, each with a will of their own. So there's no straightforward sense in which, you know, the victim group can consent to or refuse defensive assistance in the same way, intuitive way, that an individual victim can. Moreover, in many multiple victim cases, a fourth condition is going to hold, and this is just what I call a sort of mixed consent condition, which is where one subset of the members of the victim group consent to defensive assistance, but another subset refuse, so it's disagreement. And in these mixed cases, the simple consent requirement that I specified a moment ago doesn't really give much guidance, since it's indeterminate as to whether those to be defended have consented or not. So to resolve this problem, the consent requirement is going to need to be supplemented with what I call an aggregation principle, which tells us how we should move from the consent and refusal of individual victims to an all-things-considered judgment about whether or not the consent requirement has actually been satisfied or not. And probably the most common proposal, which you find often in the humanitarian intervention literature, calls for a majoritarian version of the consent principle. So more specifically, we might call this the majority consent requirement. It holds that defending others is morally justified only if the majority, or perhaps a supermajority of the members of the victim group, consent to defensive assistance or don't explicitly and competently refuse. Now, this view has obvious appeal. After all, few people dispute that democracy is a good thing, and that in many contexts, majority rule seems the morally appropriate means of deciding how to proceed in conditions of disagreement. However, despite its appeal, this majority consent principle has recently been forcefully challenged, and I think convincingly. So to demonstrate, consider the following case, which is based on an example of Andrew Altman and Kit Wellman's in their ethics paper, 2008. So let's call this the Elevator 2 case. And here the story is pretty much the same, but here we have five victims. So five victims are taking a ride in an elevator. Aggressor begins to saw through the elevator cable because she hates victims and wishes them dead. Rescuer is walking by and is able to shoot aggressor with his sniper rifle, thereby saving all the victims. However, while one victim consents to defender's intervention, or rescuer's intervention, I should say, the four remaining victims refuse because of their commitment to nonviolence. Now here, at least to me, and to many people I've presented this example to, defence just seems clearly permissible, despite the fact that 80% of the victims explicitly refuse. So this provides, I think, just a straightforward counterexample to the majority consent requirement, at least as applied to these fairly simple cases involving private individuals. And here the verdict seems to be tracking a different Mill-inspired liberal intuition. This is the basic interests of individuals place moral limits on majority rule. So when it comes to threats of serious harm, individuals may have the right to decide for themselves whether they're defended, but not the right to decide for others. So as Altman and Wellman nicely put it, it seems that when lives are at stake, it's dubious to hold that a group has this kind of normative dominion over its members. Now, by reflecting on cases like this, two sceptical conclusions seem to follow, one stronger than the other. So the weaker conclusion just holds that the majoritarian aggregation principles are false. So it's not true that the consent of the majority is a necessary condition for admissibly defending groups of victims. However, interestingly, critics of the consent requirement actually seem to go further than this, endorsing the stronger conclusion that consent is practically irrelevant in these multiple victim cases. So on this view, the victim's refusal can only render defence impermissible when it's unanimous amongst the members of the victim group, so everyone says no. And you can kind of support this claim by thinking about variations on this elevator 2 case, in which increasing numbers of refusing victims are present in the elevator. And again, it seems clear to me that, I should say at least to me, the defence would be permissible even if the number of refusing victims increases and increases and greatly outnumbers the number of consenting victims. And as people who've considered these kind of cases seem to agree with that. So we can interpret those sceptics as proposing a different, much weaker aggregation principle, which we might call the minimal consent requirement. So this view holds that defending others is morally justified only if some member of the victim group consents to defensive assistance, or again, doesn't explicitly and competently refuse. So the idea here is, look, you only need one consenter, that's enough. And of course, on this view, then there's going to be in the real world, there's going to be no actual cases in which a lack of consent is likely to render defence impermissible, since unanimous competent refusal is quite a demanding condition. And obviously this has some important implications for thinking about the morality of humanitarian intervention. So, you know, if a large-scale intervention meets all the standard conditions of just war, so just cause, proportionality, last resort, etc., then the non-unanimous refusal of victims is not going to render that intervention impermissible. And in fact, a view like this seems to have been endorsed by Jeff, who writes in his 2011 piece that the familiar principles of jus ad bellum, and especially the proportionality condition, do all the substantive work that the requirement of consent is supposed to do, is largely correct as an account of the conditions of objectively justified humanitarian intervention. And more strongly, he states that consent has no role among the conditions of objective justification in ideal theory. Now, I should point out that Jeff thinks, I think under conditions of uncertainty, consent might have some role to play, or at least in that paper. That seems to be your view. But the idea is, you know, from the fact-relative perspective, something like the minimal consent requirement is the correct interpretation of the consent requirement in multiple victim cases. Okay, so much for scepticism. In what follows, I'm going to try and provide a qualified defence of the consent requirement against the sceptics. In so doing, I'm going to accept the intuitive verdicts in cases 1 and 2, so the two elevated cases. I think the view that the first case is would be impermissible, and the second case, defence permissible, is right. So I accept the rejection of the majority consent requirement, and so I accept the weak sceptical conclusion. I also accept the deeper kind of liberal or individualist picture of morality that underpins both those judgments. But I'm going to try and deny that the strong sceptical conclusion, which is encapsulated in the minimal consent requirement, is going to follow from those judgments. So instead, I'm going to try and show how the distribution of consent and refusal is highly relevant and often decisive for permissibility, even on a kind of strictly individualist moral view. So obviously you could try and defend certain aggregation principles by talking about, you know, group agency, group rights, group interests, etc., but I think there's a way of doing it which doesn't require you to go down that route. So to do so, I'm going to start by providing a kind of what I think is a nicely unified rationale for those judgments in Elevator 1 and 2, and I'll then use that rationale to try and show why consent matters in a wider range of cases. So in a nutshell, on my view, the relevance of consent is going to be derived from the broader requirement that defensive harms be proportionate. So in other words, on my view, a lack of consent can render defensive harms impermissible because disproportionate. Okay, so I'll now look a little bit closer at the cases of Elevator 1 and 2, what's going on in those cases. So it seems to me that in the first elevator case, and in the analogous patient case, intervention seems impermissible there because it would be wrongfully paternalistic. I suppose that's the intuition. But that doesn't tell us much on its own, so we need to tell some story about what's actually wrong with paternalism. So very roughly, we can define paternalistic actions as those that involve sort of three components. First, some sort of interference with an individual. Secondly, that interference being against that person's will. And thirdly, that it's done for the sake of that individual's good. And on what I take to be a fairly standard view, when paternalism is wrong, it's wrong because individuals' autonomy has a kind of strict priority over considerations of their well-being or their good. We might say when it comes to matters of your own good, the individual is the boss. They have authority over their goods, we might say. So on this view, the wrong of paternalism lies in the fact that interfering with an individual against their will involves usurping their rightful authority over themselves. By contrast, then, paternalism might not be wrong in cases where an individual's authority over their good is compromised in some way. So either because of some sort of procedural consideration, so for example, the individual's incompetent or lacks relevant information, being coerced, etc. Or perhaps you might think of because of certain substantive considerations. So for example, that the object of the individual's will is just morally abhorrent in itself. So this seems to be what a lot of people think is going on when they think that people can't sell themselves into slavery, for example. That's just not the kind of thing that you can validly consent to. So I want to focus on one particular aspect of our self-regarding authority, which has recently been emphasised in a couple of papers by Daniel Grohl and also by David Enoch, which is that this self-regarding authority includes the normative power to generate exclusionary reasons. So that is, second-order reasons not to act for certain first-order reasons. So more specifically, the idea is that by validly refusing or withholding consent, we're able to exclude considerations of our good or well-being from the pool of reasons that others may appeal to in justifying their actions. So on this view, we might think of reasons pertaining to an individual's good or well-being as a kind of resource, what I call a moral resource. And as the kind of owners of that resource, individuals have the exclusive right to prevent others from using it for certain purposes. So the thought is that when an individual validly withholds consent or refuses another's action, and that action will benefit them, others commit a form of what we might call a moral trespass by appealing to benefit-based reasons in order to justify performing that action. So the idea is therein lies the distinctive wrongfulness of paternalism. And I think that sort of general authority-based account of paternalism's wrongness gives us a nice explanation of the intuitive verdict in the first elevator case. And I think we can see this by remembering that the justification for killing culpable aggressors really has two basic parts. So firstly, and most obviously, we appeal to the fact that the aggressor is liable to defensive harm. But of course, liability functions only negatively in the justification by removing the normal constraint on intentional killing. But of course, that alone is not sufficient to justify killing. To say that someone's liable just means that they would not be wronged by being harmed or being killed. But the fact that an action wouldn't wrong someone doesn't generate any positive reasons to perform it. And we still have significant moral reasons not to kill even liable individuals. To help see this, consider the fairly uncontroversial requirement that, other things being equal, we're required to minimise the number of aggressors we defensively kill, even if it's true that they're all liable. So if five people attack me, and I can defend myself in two ways, kill all five of them or only kill one. It seems pretty obvious that I should only kill one, but that's true even if we accept that, taken individually, each one is fully liable to defensive killing. So given that, we can see that justification for killing culpable aggressors requires a second component, which is going to identify a positive moral reason in favour of killing that's sufficient to defeat those reasons against. And obviously this reason is pretty straightforward. Killing the aggressor is necessary to protect the continued life and well-being of the victim. But I think once we recognise that additional welfarist aspect, we can see more precisely why defensively killing the aggressor in the first elevator case is impermissible. So on the view that individuals have this kind of authority over their good, the victim's refusal prevents that welfarist component of the justification from being satisfied. So put another way, by exercising his normative power, in this case her normative power, victim closes off a class of reasons from contributing to the justification for killing aggressor, those pertaining to the fact that she would be benefited. So as a result, there's just insufficient, what we might say, admissible moral reason that the rescuer can appeal to in order to justify killing aggressor and defending the victim. So rescuer, in this case, both lacks a justification for killing the aggressor and would also commit this kind of additional moral wrong against the victim by doing so, by using a moral resource that the victim has declared may not be used for that purpose. Now, interestingly, I think this kind of authority-based view of paternalism's wrongness also helps explain the intuitive judgment in the case of Elevator 2. So in assessing this case, I propose that we just proceed by a composition. So we treat each of the five victims in the same way that we treat the single victim in the first elevator case. So that, I think that's in line with the broadly liberal individualistic picture of morality that I endorse and is also endorsed by people who are quite sceptical about consent. So the basic thought here is that the normative consequences that follow from each victim's consent and refusal shouldn't change simply because people are threatened in conjunction with others. And I'll revisit this assumption at the end of the paper. So on this view, on this way of looking at things, each of the four victims who refuses successfully exercises their normative power to make their good morally inadmissible for the purposes of justification, just as the single victim does in the first elevator case. But all that changes between elevator one and two is whether that exercise of a normative power settles the question of the all things considered permissibility of defence. And in this case, I think it doesn't, due to an important feature of elevator two, which is simply that each individual victim's good is sufficient to justify the total defensive harm involved in defending everybody, i.e. killing the aggressor. I think that feature explains the intuitive permissibility of defending the five victims in this case, despite the fact that four of them don't want to be defended. Since the good of each victim is sufficient to justify the total defensive harm, i.e. killing the aggressor, and one victim consents, then rescuer has sufficient admissible moral reasons to justify killing the aggressor. And furthermore, I think this theory kind of nicely explains why defending the five doesn't involve paternalistically wronging anybody. This is because justifying the defensive act doesn't require appealing to the good or welfare of any particular victim who refuses defensive assistance, unlike in Elevator 1, where to justify the action you have to appeal to the good of someone who's refused. So in this case, it isn't true of any victim that they're defended against their will for the sake of their own good. So even though the rescuer's action isn't endorsed by four of the victims, his justification for defending them doesn't involve making use of their moral resources without their permission. So that's how I think we should think about cases one and two. And importantly, I think that analysis of the two cases provides the resources to explain why, against the skeptics, consent might often be highly relevant in multiple victim cases more generally. So the key point here is that there's a crucial difference between cases like Elevator 1 and Elevator 2 and all other multiple victim cases, or multiple victim cases in general, including, importantly, cases of humanitarian intervention. And that difference is that in many of those cases, defending others not only involves killing culpable aggressors, as in those first two Elevator cases, but also collaterally killing innocent people. And that's significant because when there are those additional harms, it's not true, as in these two Elevator cases, that each victim's good is sufficient to justify the total amount of harm that would be caused by defending them. So instead, when defence involves collateral killing, the number of victims becomes highly relevant for reasons of proportionality. So putting things quite crudely, the proportionality requirement holds that the relevant goods achieved by a defensive action must be sufficient to outweigh the relevant bad effects that the action causes. Obviously, it's more complicated than that, but that'll do for our purposes. And when those bad effects include killing innocent persons, we usually think that defence is only permissible if it will prevent a significantly greater number of innocent persons from being killed. So, for example, take our judgments in the Standard Trolley case. It suggests there that at least a 5-to-1 ratio between lives saved and innocents collaterally killed might be required. And at the very least, it wouldn't be proportionate in that case to kill one innocent person as a side effect in order to save just one innocent person from death. At least most people think that. So the idea here is just that when the use of defensive force involves collaterally killing a number of innocent people, a lack of victims might render defence impermissible, and impermissible because disproportionate. And my key contention is that a lack of consenting victims might be able to render defence disproportionate for precisely the same reason, i.e. that the defensive act would not be supported by sufficient positive reasons to offset the relevant bad effects. So just as in the first two Elevator cases, the idea here is that individual victims can, by refusing defensive assistance, exclude their good from the pool of reasons that the rescuer might be able to appeal to in order to justify defending them. However, and this is the important point, in cases where the number of victims matters because defence involves these additional collateral harms, the moral unavailability of those reasons might be enough to render defensive force disproportionate, depending on the facts of the case. So I think if that view is correct, then that shows that helps show that the sceptical aggregation principle, so what I call the minimal consent requirement, the idea that you only need one member of a group to consent, is mistaken, or at least looks like it might be mistaken. So in my view, there are going to be many cases in which it's not permissible to defend a group, even though it's true that some members consent to being defended. So just to illustrate this with a nice concrete case, consider a variation on case two. So let's call this Elevator 3. It's very similar to Elevator 2, and the story goes like this. So again, five victims are taking a ride in the elevator. Aggressor begins to saw through the elevator cable because she hates the victims and she wishes them dead. Rescuers walking by, and instead of a sniper rifle, this time he's able to blow up the aggressor by throwing a grenade at him, thereby killing aggressor, but also killing a bystander as a side effect. So that's the key difference between this case and the previous case, the presence of the bystander and the fact that they'd be collaterally killed. And again, while one victim consents to rescuer's intervention, four victims refuse because of their commitment to non-violence. Now, in this case, I contend it's actually impermissible for a rescuer to defend the five victims. And in my view, that's because doing so would just be disproportionate. Despite the fact that saving the five victims would be permissible, and therefore proportionate, if each of the victims did consent to defensive assistance. So in my view, you might say, in essence, the four victims' refusal morally converts a case of saving sorry, of killing one to save five into a case of killing one to save one. And my hypothesis, saving one life is insufficiently valuable to justify killing one person as a side effect. So before moving on to consider some problems with this view, here are three features of the proposal that I think are worth highlighting. So on this view, consent functions in the morality of defensive harm as an internal component of the broader requirement that harms be proportionate. So the thought being that an individual's consent, or more accurately their non-refusal, is required in order for benefits to that individual to count positively in the proportionality calculation. Secondly, this view is emphatically not majoritarian in any way. So what matters morally on this view is the number of consenting victims, not the proportion of consenters within a group. And thirdly, on this view, the actual distribution of consent needed to satisfy the consent requirement is going to be context sensitive, so it will vary on a case-by-case basis. And that's just because the consent required in order to make defence proportionate is going to depend on lots of contingent factors. So most obviously, the number of victims who are going to be threatened and the amount of collateral harm that defending them would cause. So in cases where there's a large number of victims and a relatively small amount of collateral harm, only a small proportion of the victims need to consent in order to satisfy proportionality, on my view. But as the number of victims gets smaller and the amount of collateral harm gets greater, a correspondingly larger proportion of the victims must consent, potentially to the point at which unanimous consent would be required for permissible defence. So I think that might be true in Elevator 3, for example. It seems to me that in this case, if we think that 5 is the threshold at which it's permissible to kill one as a side effect, but not 4, on my view, you would need the consent of every single person. So my view is, in a sense, both weaker and stronger than the majoritarian proposal. There are some cases in which only unanimous consent will do, and other cases in which potentially the consent of just one person will do. It all depends on the facts of the case. So to put things a bit more precisely, the view that I propose can be captured in the following aggregation principle. It's a bit of a mouthful, this one, but necessary, I think. So this view holds that defending others is morally justified only if a sufficient subset of the members of the victim group consent to defensive assistance. Now, of course, that's pretty empty. The important point on my view is that a subset counts as sufficient if the benefits of defence to the members of that subset are sufficient to justify the total amount of defensive harm that defending the group will cause. So that's, as I said, a bit complicated. Here's a slightly more intuitive way of trying to understand this interpretation of the requirement. So the thought is that since, on my view, an individual victim's refusal serves to make their good inadmissible for the purposes of justifying harms, there's a sense in which you can treat a victim's refusal as morally equivalent to their non-existence. Importantly, only a sense. We shouldn't take that too literally. But given that thought, one way of determining whether the consent requirement has been met in a particular case, on my view, is by applying the following counterfactual tests. So we say, look, imagine if the refusing members of the victim group didn't exist. Would defending the remaining members be permissible? And if the answer is no, then on my view, the consent requirement has not been met and defence is impermissible. Okay, so that's the general view. I think there are lots of things to object in there. I'm sure you're going to find plenty. But let me wrap things up by considering what I think is the strongest and most interesting objection to this view. And this objection targets one of the central claims which underpins what I've called the proportionate consent requirement that I've argued for. And this is the claim that we should take each individual victim in isolation. So we should think that the normative consequences that follow from each victim's consent and refusal are kind of morally independent of one another. So in other words, the idea that we just treat each victim in a multiple victim case in the same way that we would treat a single victim, and then we just proceed by addition. So you might challenge that idea by pointing out that, look, in these multiple victim cases, there are these important other regarding considerations at play, which are normally absent in single victim cases. So this kind of addition isn't appropriate. More specifically, in many of these multiple victim cases, on my view, a victim's decision whether to consent or refuse being defended can significantly affect other people's prospects for survival. So in particular, on my view, a single individual can, by refusing, bring it about that others will not be defended from lethal harms by removing their good from the pot, so thus thereby sort of negating the rescuer's justification for defending everybody. So, for example, if we think about a variation on the third elevator case, let's call the variation elevator 3 star. So in this case, only one victim refuses rather than four. So on my view, that single person's refusal could be enough to make it impermissible for... a single victim's refusal could be enough to make it impermissible for the rescuer to defend everybody, so to defend the four consenting people. So, you know, the victim's sort of decision about whether to consent or refuse is really a matter of life or death for the remaining four victims, because that single victim, on my view, has this normative control over whether or not there exists a justification for saving everybody. So given that, you might sort of plausibly object that this other-regarding element undermines the claim that we can just assess each victim's consent and refusal in isolation. So instead, you might think the fact that an individual's refusal will just have these serious negative consequences for other people places limits on its moral effectiveness. So to put this more precisely, in terms of two claims, you might claim, firstly, that in sort of variation on this case, where just one person refuses, you might claim the single victim's refusal, or you might claim, sorry, that the single refuser would act impermissibly by refusing. In fact, you might say, look, they're just morally required to consent, because by consenting, they'll bring it about that the four other people who do want to be saved will actually be saved by furnishing a rescuer with a justification for doing so. So first claim, the single refuser acts wrongly in the variation on this case. Secondly, one might take that and then, following David Estlund, hold that the fact that it would be morally wrong for a victim to refuse renders their refusal morally invalid, so not morally effective. And in virtue of that invalidity, you might hold the normative situation is as it would been, or would have been, if the individual had in fact consented. So their attempt to kind of withdraw their good from the pot hasn't been successful. Now, for our purposes, what's important is that means that, contrary to my view, you might say the victim's good is in fact morally available for justifying defensive harm in this case, or this variation on this case. And if that good is in fact morally available, then the rescuer does in fact possess a justification for defending the whole victim group after all. You might say, look, since the non-consenting single victim is morally required to make their moral resources available, well, then the rescuer may legitimately make use of those resources despite their refusal without wronging them, because those goods haven't been sort of morally closed off from being used. Now, if you think that objection is successful, then I'm mistaken to claim that when defending groups of victims, we can only appeal to the benefits to victims who have consented in order to justify defending them. So refusal is going to be a hell of a lot less decisive than I've claimed it is, if that objection is correct. And that's because our normative powers to exclude reasons pertaining to our good are considerably limited by the effects that exclusion would have on other people. Now, I must admit that that objection I still find intuitively powerful, even though I think it ultimately fails. So I think the force of the objection comes from an analogy between what I've termed our moral resources, so that is the moral reasons pertaining to our good or welfare, and just ordinary material resources that we possess moral powers over, so such as our bodies, money, labour, property, etc. And when it comes to those material resources, it does seem very plausible to think, firstly, that individuals can be morally required to contribute those resources when they're doing so will bring about benefits to others, such as saving lives, most obviously. And it also seems pretty plausible that, at least in some cases, an individual's refusal to contribute those resources will be morally ineffective, and so those resources may be used by others without wronging their owner. So, for example, imagine I can easily save four people's lives by using my body to pull the four non-swimmers from a pond. Well, it may well be that I'm morally required to do so, and it may also be the case that others can permissibly use my body for that purpose if I refuse to do so myself. So Victor Tadros has got lots of cases like this. However, I don't think those ideas really hold in the case of our moral resources. So more specifically, it doesn't seem true to me that if an individual can bring it about that others will be saved from harm by making their goods available as a justificatory resource, then they're morally required to do so. In fact, it's not clear to me that they would have any moral reason to do so. So if we don't have reasons to bring about the saving of others in that particular way, then we obviously can't act wrongly by refusing to do so. So hence there are no grounds for invalidating our refusal. So to help see this, consider the following case. It's a long one, I'm afraid. Okay, so the case goes like this. Aggressor is about to set a trolley rolling towards four innocent victims who were tied to the main tracks because she hates them and wishes them dead. Rescuer can divert the trolley onto a sidetrack, thereby saving the four. However, there's one innocent person, a bystander, on the sidetrack who will be killed if she flips the switch. While this is all happening, further down the main track, someone called Barry is crossing the tracks on his way to work when he sees events unfolding up the line. While he's crossing, the trolley also threatens his life, but he can avoid being harmed simply by stepping off the tracks if he wants to. Okay, so in this case, assume firstly that it's permissible to collaterally kill one innocent person in order to save five, but not to save four. So just assume that ratio. Obviously, if you don't agree with that ratio, just insert whatever one you like. The case will still work. And assume also that the rescuer will only divert the trolley if they have a justification for doing so. So they'll only flip if it's morally permissible to flip. Given that, Barry has the following choice. Firstly, he could stay on the tracks and thereby bring about the saving of the four by making his good morally available to justify flipping the switch. Or he can step off the tracks, so thereby failing to bring about the saving of the four, again by making his good available. So here's the question. Would Barry act wrongly by stepping off the tracks? Does he have any moral reason to stay put and not continue on his way to work? It seems clear to me, well, at least to me, I should say, and at least to most people I put this to, that Barry just has absolutely no reason to stay on the tracks. And to help emphasize this, imagine that Barry has already crossed the tracks before he becomes aware of the situation further up the line. Does he have any reason to step back on the tracks in order to bring about the saving of the four? Again, I think surely he doesn't. Now, the point of this case is it's meant to be relevantly analogous to that variation on the third elevator case, Elevator Star, in which four victims consent to defence, but just one person refuses. So it seems to me that both that single refusing victim and Barry are in a similar situation. So they both have the ability to bring about the saving of four other people by making their moral resources available to a rescuer. So in the case of the single refusing victim, they make those resources available by consenting. And in the case of Barry, he makes those resources available just by staying put. Now, it seems to me, if we think that Barry has no reason to stay put, we should conclude that the non-consenting victim also has no reason to consent. And I think if that's right, then victim's refusal just can't be rendered normatively ineffective by the fact that its being effective would morally prevent other victims from being defended. Now, just to kind of cement this thought, putting aside just intuitions about the case of Barry, there seems to me to be a more general point to be made against this objection. So the idea that individuals can be morally obligated to consent in order to activate justifications just seems to rely on the idea, I find this a really weird idea, that we can have moral reasons to alter the balance of moral reasons. And that just seems really odd to me. You might think, look, after all, what I ought to do is surely determined by the balance of pre-existing moral reasons, and not what the balance of reasons would be if I acted in a certain way. To rephrase this, you might say, look, how can the balance of reasons itself be reason-giving? To say otherwise just seems to involve a weird kind of double counting. You know, the reasons in favour have been counted once, it's been determined that those reasons aren't sufficient to justify an action, and then that fact is supposed to give us extra reasons to add to the pot in order to try and tip the balance. It just seems very strange to me. Okay, but things aren't quite as simple as I claimed. The problem is that there do seem to be these cases in which it doesn't seem that implausible to think that you can have reasons to act in order to change the balance of moral reasons. So here's a variation on the case. So again, the aggressor is about to set their trolley rolling towards four innocent victims, and they're tied to the main tracks. And again, because she hates them and wishes them dead. And again, rescuer can divert the trolley onto a sidetrack, thereby saving the four. However, there's an innocent bystander on the sidetrack who will be killed if they do so. Now, in this case, Barry is passing by the sidetracks on his way to work when he sees events unfolding up the line, and he's able to just push that innocent bystander off the sidetracks. So, in this case, if Barry does nothing, the four victims will not be saved, because Rescuer doesn't have a justification for saving them. Alternatively, if he pushes the bystander off the sidetracks, the four victims will be saved, because he would have made it the case that Rescuer wouldn't be unjustified in saving them. Now, in this case, it does seem to me that Barry ought to push the bystander. And again, it seems to me that this is because he would be bringing about the saving of four victims by altering the balance of moral reasons that apply to the rescuer. So this is odd, very odd. But despite the interesting result, it seems to me doubtful that it applies to the kind of rescue cases that I've been discussing, since, at least I think, Trolley 2 is this very particular kind of case. So what's going on here, I think, is that, and this is quite speculative, maybe you can help me with this, but it seems to me that what's going on is that by pushing the bystander, Barry would be bringing about the saving of the four by removing all the moral obstacles to rescuer doing so. Now, if he does so, he doesn't render the rescuer's action justified. Rather, he makes it the case that the rescuer's action, flipping the switch, just no longer stands in need of justification at all, because there's no longer any pro tanto wrongs involved in saving the four if he pushes the person who would be harmed as a side effect out of the way. By contrast, in the cases I'm interested in, so cases structured like Elevator 3, the question there is whether individuals have moral reasons to make it the case that otherwise unjustified rights violations become justified by adding additional moral reasons in favour of killing that outweigh the reasons against. So I think, and again, I'm not quite sure about this, maybe you can help me. In those cases, it seems to me very strange to claim that we have reasons to alter the balance. And again, you might just think, look, if the pre-existing reasons in favour of killing the innocent person turn out to be insufficient to justify doing so, how can this generate any reasons to add extra additional considerations in favour of killing to the scales in order to tip the balance? Again, it seems to me that there must be some sort of double counting going on there. It seems very strange. So it seems to me, while it's plausible to think that we might have moral reasons to remove moral obstacles, I don't think it makes sense to claim that we have reasons to kind of manufacture new justifications for other people. And I think since the objection under consideration relies on that latter notion, that we can have reason, indeed be obligated to manufacture justifications for others, I think that objection fails. But despite that, I still find it very intuitively pulling, so I'm not sure. Okay, so let me just wrap things up. So I'm not quite sure that the specific proposal I put forward is right, but I do think the general approach to the question that I've taken is the right one. So I do think that the role of consent within the morality of defensive harm is going to be worked out by thinking about the ground and limits of individuals' authority over themselves and their good. Thanks very much.